This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Going into their yard, they discovered the world.
Heads up, extreme climate change is coming to your neighborhood. Longtime climate activist Mike Tidwell decided to chronicle the ugly changes around his home in Tacoma Park, Maryland, right on the edge of Washington, D.C. Mike is a longtime author. He's written for National Geographic and the Washington Post. In 2002, he left it all to create a new nonprofit, the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. Of course, he kept publishing some really good books. Tidwell wrote about the hurricane threats to the Gulf before Katrina. Mike spoke to us in 2012, and then again last year, we talked about Hurricane Helene in the Appalachians. His new book is The Lost Trees of Willow Avenue, A Story of Climate and Hope on One American Street. From his home in Maryland, Mike Tidwell, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, it's so great to be with you.
At first, I didn't want to cover this new book. I mean, why look into one place? I was worried it would be boring, and I can say right away, it's not. We forget, though, that we all live somewhere, and that is where climate change really happens. Do you see more focus on what I would call the hyper-local as climate continues to unfold?
I do. I was honestly, when I had this thought experiment, what if I paid attention to my one street, my one block in a town right on the border with D.C. for 1 year, what would I find? I knew that there were things going on all around me, but I was astonished by how much was happening. The book is first and foremost about the decline of really big trees on my block, but I also record people with Lyme disease. I myself have chronic Lyme disease because the ticks aren't killed off in as many numbers in the winters here, flooding. And I think what I'm seeing on my block is what people, if they're encouraged to pay attention, everyone is seeing it wherever they live. So yes, I think everyone sees what happened with the wildfires in California, with Hurricane Helene, but now people are feeling it in the form of basements that flood and loved ones that get sick.
And you do write vividly about seemingly magical impacts of being near giant trees like the oaks of Maryland. I've felt that myself. The ancient Celts in Britain worshipped oak groves. Old German tribes did too. There must be something there. But this isn't just mysticism. You tracked it down. You found we can actually feel and measure the effects. Talk to us about forest bathing.
Yeah, it has been widely established that people just feel better near trees. Patients in hospitals, if you can just see a tree in the distance, your recovery rate is faster. Trees tend to lower our cortisol levels, our stress levels. They improve our immune systems. In my neighborhood, historically, it's a city, Tacoma Park, that's so obsessed with trees. We call ourselves Tree City USA. Most of the streets are named after trees, whether it's willow, dogwood, maple. We're obsessed with trees. And until recently, until really the last 5 or 6 years, our tree canopy, our urban tree canopy, was in pretty good shape. But now, because of fantastic rainfall in 2018 that weakened the roots of our trees, triggered a mold in the soil, and then ambrosia beetles followed through, we are losing so many of our trees. Our tree permit removal rate that the city keeps track of is at least double historic averages. And in recent years, it's been three times the historic average for tree removal of damaged trees. So we're seeing this climate change impact. And it's not me saying it's climate change that's killing our trees. It's the city of Tacoma Park arborists and some of the tree experts in this region who point to wild weather extremes from climate change. So as these trees disappear, one of the questions I ask in my book, if trees make us feel better and boost our immune system and make us happier, what happens when they disappear? What happens when you live on a street that used to have many big trees and then they're gone? And I argue that there's reason to believe that on top of the other health impacts of climate change from Lyme disease and what have you, that our immune systems are generally being weakened because we're losing that contact with trees.
What is Lyme disease? And tell us a little bit more about your own battle with it and the deer.
Yeah, Lyme disease is a bacteria that is spread by ticks. Those ticks can be carried by deer or white-footed mice. And because our winters are so much milder, fewer of the ticks are dying in the winter. And also, we now have deer populations that are just out of control in the mid-Atlantic part of the United States. And those deer are spreading ticks as well. So it's a full-blown epidemic. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency uses Lyme disease as one of its key indicators of climate change. There's such a close connection between warming and tick survival that they use it as an indicator of a changing climate. I got bit by a tick in 2008, was misdiagnosed with this bacteria that can cause muscle stiffness. It can cause, eventually, if it's not treated, paralysis and serious problems. And I was misdiagnosed for years and years. Finally, I was diagnosed in 2014 and discovered I had had multiple tick bites and multiple Lyme infections. And now I have been taking lots of antibiotics off and on for the last 10 years. I also supplement that with acupuncture. But it's a tough disease. If you can't catch it early, it can become chronic, like for me. And it just, it's manageable for me, but it, for example, today I'm experiencing inflammation from Lyme disease. I'm lightheaded. I have arthritic-like symptoms, and it'll come and go. And it's very prominent. In writing this book, I just started asking my neighbors and members of my church and the local Boy Scouts. I was shocked by how many people had been battling tick-borne diseases where I live.
Also wrapped in this book are, well, it's just your experience in the climate movement in the United States and the way that movement has changed. And you kind of outline a compromise there. It seems like, I'm going to say around 2010, Greens realized global warming would not be stopped. So then the new goal was to a kind of a reset to avoiding the worst consequences. But now it seems like things are so advanced, we can't even settle for a good enough world. Is that falling out of reach? Where are we going?
Alex, it's a great question. I've dedicated my life to fighting climate change for the last 23 years now, and we've all just seen the impacts get worse and worse. I mean, for example, you can now throw a dart at a spinning, lacquered globe, and wherever that dart lands, that one little spot on the globe, wherever it is, randomly selected, you can write a whole book about the impacts of climate change right there. And the reason I know that is I just did it. I just wrote a book about the impacts of climate change on my one block in Maryland on the border with D.C. So the impacts are very profound now, and it's very serious how it's affecting us. I wish I could say that clean energy alone could solve this problem. I believe that despite Trump, the clean energy revolution is just unstoppable all over the world. I make that argument in the book. Solar is we're building enough solar every day, a gigawatt, every day around the world, equal to a nuclear power plant. Emissions are going down in Europe. Australia is going to reach nearly 100% clean electricity by 2030. The world is going on. We're going to make the switch to clean energy. The problem is we're just not doing it fast enough. The argument I make is it's too late for clean energy alone to save us. Dr. James Hansen, America's most famous climate scientist, has been sounding that alarm for several years now. We have to, in addition to getting off of carbon, we need to reflect sunlight, he says, from the planet for a few decades. And he's at least appealing for greater research investment in ideas of acting, you know, human beings being like a human volcano and studying whether we could put sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere like volcanoes do. Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in 1991 cooled the entire planet by more than a degree Fahrenheit for nearly 2 years. Could we do that as human beings? Could we do it safely? Are there other ways to make clouds brighter to reflect more sunlight? Can we, you know, just paint every rooftop and parking lot and street white in the world? Would that help? We need to study these things because I fear that unless we reflect sunlight, we may just reach a point of climate change that we cannot adapt to. There are some who say, what about a direct air capture of carbon? Can't we just suck the carbon out of the air? Unfortunately, that technology today is where solar technology was in the 1970s. It's in its infancy. Maybe it'll make faster strides, but I feel like if we're going to maintain some semblance of a habitable planet and organize human civilization, we need to, in addition to clean energy, reflect some sunlight away from the planet and at least begin studying that.
And you and your friend, the scientist Ning Zeng, found a logical way to help a little bit by reducing all the carbon that would be released as those big tree trunks and branches rotted as they were hauled out of your city and all along the East Coast. In 2008, Dr. Zeng published on carbon sequestration via wood burial. I even heard suggestions humans might need to cut down part of the boreal forest and just bury all the trees to capture more carbon out of the air. Few people supported that. That seems too far. But where dead wood is going to be harvested, and it will be to clean up the woods to stop all these wildfires, it should be buried. How would that help?
Well, Dr. Ning Zeng at University of Maryland lives in my neighborhood, and my question for him was, I invited him to my block to see these massive tree stumps, these great, wonderful oak trees that had died. And I asked him, where are these trees going? Because a lot of the arborists and the tree services tell you, oh, that wood is repurposed. It's turned into wood chips. It's turned into specialty lumber. But Ning Zeng at the University of Maryland said, no, that's not the case. So many trees are dying in the mid-Atlantic that the wood chip market is flooded. There's only so much that can be used for lumber because street trees don't grow super straight. So only about 15% can be repurposed. And the rest is going to landfills or incinerators. And his goal is to, instead of having them decompose rapidly in landfills and elsewhere, we could just systematically bury literally hundreds of millions of tons of these trees worldwide. And in my book, I follow his research and I follow him where he buries the first 100 tons of trees on a farm in Maryland north of Baltimore. Those trees had died on the streets of Baltimore because of extreme weather, and they were piling up in a woodlot, and he took 100 tons to bury them to demonstrate to the world that if you bury them in the right soil, into high clay content soil in the proper circumstances, those trees can stay intact for 1,000 years underground. He calls it reverse coal. In fact, he did a very small study in north near Montreal where digging the tomb to bury some trees, they accidentally hit another tree, a cedar tree that was, they tested it, was 3,000 years old, and it still had bark on it. So his argument is we can sequester carbon for centuries, if not thousands of years, by properly burying them, and that's one way to store carbon and help fight climate change.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with author and climate activist Mike Tidwell. Mike is the founder of Chesapeake Climate Action Network. You discovered the idea of solar shading to cool the Earth came from a Soviet scientist way back in 1974. Global warming was known even then. He said we should mimic volcanoes, as you say. What are your feelings? Could this work?
Well, in my book, The Lost Trees of Willow Avenue, I first chronicle the fact that this was the last thing I wanted to be thinking about in my lifetime. First, I dedicated my life. I've been to jail a dozen times, blocking coal plants, stopping coal plant construction, pipelines, street demonstrations. I've organized rallies in support of clean energy on U.S. Capitol Hill and in state capitals. I've been all in on this. I'm a vegetarian. I have solar on my roof, an electric car, so I'm totally green. But it's not enough. And in my book, I describe this painful realization that if the world of my 27-year-old son is going to look anything like the world we all grew up in, that we have to, again, at least research these ideas. Will it work? In terms of solar radiation modification, in terms of putting sulfur dioxide using high-flying airplanes in the stratosphere in a calculated way, similar to volcanoes, I have not met a single scientist who says it won't work, that it won't cool the planet. Everyone agrees that putting sulfur into the stratosphere will cool the planet. The question is, how much? How do you disperse it? what would be the consequences, known and unknown? The reality is that we've already conducted a lot of experiments on this. One, we have volcano behavior to look at in terms of consequences. We have the fact that burning fossil fuels emits sulfur dioxide as well. It's one of the byproducts of burning fossil fuels. So we have been inadvertently cooling the planet, but it's been masked by the even greater concentration of CO2 that's caused warming. And in fact, now as we get off of fossil fuels, as we clean up, for example, the fuel in shipping, maritime ships around the world, we're seeing that mask come off, and there's less sulfur being put into the atmosphere, and we're getting so-called bonus warming in the atmosphere, which you've had guests who've talked about that. So, yes, it can work. We need to study it and study it and study it and develop a international governance for geoengineering to figure out, yes or no, do the world's nations want to do this? If so, how? And what are the safeguards we have to add if we're going to do it at all?
In 2022, Congress did mandate a plan for research into blocking the sun to reduce warming. I wonder, has that gone ahead, or will Elon Musk's kids just slash that too?
Well, in 2023, the Biden administration issued guidelines on how to do research on this. In 2020, Congress authorized the aspects of the federal government to just measure aerosols in the atmosphere, the various particles that reflect sunlight. And those tests are going on between the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. They do have planes that are just measuring aerosols, in part to see what's already up there. If you were to methodically add sulfur particles to the stratosphere, what's already up there? How much would be needed? Also, by monitoring aerosol levels in the stratosphere, it is a way, and continuing to monitor them, it's a way to know if some rogue nation or rogue individual is adding sulfur of their own or some other aerosol. So we could have an alarm system so we could see if someone's doing this without international approval. But we can also study what's the composition of the stratosphere now, and how might that interact with future efforts to artificially cool the planet through additional aerosols.
Radio EcoShock guest Dr. David Keith estimated as few as 10 aircraft could create a solar shield, releasing about 250,000 tons of sulfur per year in the early phase. So that's something that even Elon Musk could just decide to do and do it. Are there any international regulations, or is there any mechanism to stop him or the dictator of North Korea or anyone who feels like it from shading the earth?
No, there are no international treaties, shockingly, to prevent either a country or an individual from launching sulfur canisters into the atmosphere. I mean, with powerful enough artillery, you could actually shoot sulfur into the atmosphere using your military or your own private airplanes. This is scary, and we should, in my view, have an international treaty that bans any individual or country from doing this. The only way we should ever do it, if we do it, should be through international governance and consensus. But yes, the reality is it is not that expensive to put enough sulfur into the stratosphere to cool the planet and to mimic a volcano. It is not a technological challenge. It is doable. It is affordable for people like Elon Musk, and that should concern us all. And as I say in my book, there are a lot of very responsible scientists who want to investigate this carefully, not have someone just go off and do it casually.
And one of the solutions you write about in your book is distributed agriculture. Some might call it victory gardens or urban farming. Why do we need all of it? It doesn't seem like just having a garden is going to save the world, but it certainly can save each one of us, I think.
Yeah, one of the things I write about my urban street is that as big trees die from extreme weather, and it causes grief, and it impacts us all emotionally, it impacts flooding in my neighborhood, we have cascading impacts of climate change. You know, scientists talk about cascading impacts of climate change globally. When you melt Arctic ice, then you have darker oceans exposed that absorb even more CO2, and you have that feedback loop. Well, we have cascading impacts of climate change on my block. When these really big oak trees die, they're not only gone for shading and comfort for human beings, but when these big rainstorms now come, those root systems are not there to absorb the rain that we're getting. So that greater runoff added to even bigger storms means more rain flows, for example, into the basement of my church, which is a block from my house. And the city government where I live in Tacoma Park has had to spend $45,000 elevating a sidewalk 14 inches, not because the sidewalk needed repair. It was perfectly good. They elevated the sidewalk to create a flood berm, a half-block-long flood berm, to keep water out of the basement preschool of my church. And a lot of that additional water is coming from gaps in the canopy from trees being gone. So we have these cascading impacts. And the silver lining, if you want to call it that, when some of the biggest trees in my neighborhood die, it is very common for solar panels to go up. So a house that was shaded by the tree is now very sunny, and we see a lot of solar panels expanding in my neighborhood. As, tragically, the tree canopy comes down, the positive result is more solar. And also, as trees come down, there's more people gardening in my neighborhood. Right on my block, right across from my street, a 80-year-old willow oak came down in 2023 that I write about in my book, The Lost Trees of Willow Avenue. And my neighbor Dorothy, who's a midwife across the street, she and I started a garden right there on the curb. You know, now we're growing tomatoes and we're growing beans. We're going to expand it. You know, is this enough to feed us? No. But if everyone were to plant gardens in sufficiently sunny places in our urban and suburban neighborhoods, we could create a serious amount of food. In fact, the United States did this during World War II with the so-called victory gardens, where as much as 40% of all fresh produce during the war years were actually produced by gardens on street corners and backyards, even on windowsills. So I comment that in my neighborhood, there are more and more gardens. They're just popping up along street corners and curbsides, and people growing more and more food, in part as a consequence of the tree canopy declining. And this is what we need to do in the long term to make our communities more resilient with climate change, grow more of our food closer to our homes.
And I just want to take a quick second to read a quote from your book, which seems pretty right on for where we are right now. You write, "The larger lesson for the climate movement is still there. Governments can grow ill too. They can fall prey to disease. Like people, like trees, like the planet itself, governments have their own version of an immune system that, when attacked, can either fail or, as on January 6th, narrowly survive," ending that quote. And right now, though, we have the attack on everything green, even the language of climate science. It seems like a pretty sick government in America. I'm hoping Europe, China, and India, and Australia don't fall into that same trap. We need the climate movement to keep going. Will it?
Well, it's a great question. There's no doubt that the Trump administration is waging war on clean energy. The problem that they're going to face is that electric cars are becoming cheaper than internal combustion engine vehicles. Solar is the cheapest energy source in the history of energy. As I said before, we're generating around the world a gigawatt of solar, equal to a nuclear power plant every day. And China is leading that as much as anyone. China is leading on wind and solar. The Europeans are leading on offshore wind. China is building more electric cars than any other country and now exporting them to the world. So no matter what the Trump administration does, it cannot hold back the rest of the world. It cannot hold back many of the blue states in the United States, like California, like my state of Maryland, where I live. Commitments to clean energy, commitments to expanding wind and solar will continue. Now, can the Trump administration slow this down? Yes, they can, but they cannot stop it. They cannot reverse the clean energy revolution. So yes, our country is ailing. Its immune system is being attacked, but I think we'll survive and the world will as well. Because if nothing else, just based on market terms, these technologies are just becoming too convenient, too useful, and too cheap to stop forever.
As we wrap this up, Mike, do you have any parting words for our listeners?
I will say that, like many of your listeners, I have been committed to solving the climate crisis for most of my adult life. I've given everything I can to wind and solar and environmental justice, and this is a tough time. But I, by writing this book, The Lost Trees of Willow Avenue, I went through a grieving process. I reconciled myself to what's possible and what's not possible with many of the tools we've been advocating for. I believe in science. I know that investigating ways to reflect sunlight away from our planet, I think, has promise. We'll see in the coming years. In the meantime, we have to hold the line. We have to stand up and speak the truth on climate. We have to take care of our neighbors right next door. We have to support officials who believe in climate change. Times have been hard before on this planet, during the Great Depression and at other times, and we've gotten through it. And I think we'll get through these challenges from the Trump administration and others, and there is hope at the other end. I believe that.
From Maryland, we've been speaking with author and leading climate activist Mike Tidwell. You can find him at ChesapeakeClimate.org. And on various social media platforms. Mike's new book is The Lost Trees of Willow Avenue, A Story of Climate and Hope on One American Street. It's coming out soon. Mike, I am glad you are still out there, still trying to find a way. Thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you so much, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
If you want to explore a planet, start where you live. You can find strange, intelligent life forms in connected networks right there. Anyone of any age can become a citizen scientist. Our guide is award-winning conservation biologist and author Thor Hansen. From his guerrilla years in Uganda through deep dives into seeds and bees, Dr. Hansen passes on ways to explore. His new book is Close to Home, The Wonders of Nature Just Outside Your Door. From the Pacific Northwest, Thor Hansen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So you worked overseas, traveled, you connect with people all over the world. What brought you back to study your own home ground?
You know, it all started with a thump, if you will, and it's a sound that none of us likes to hear, but it was the thump of a bird hitting my office window. And I work in a little shack right in our backyard, and I heard this thump, and I ran outside thinking, oh no, and here was this poor bird that had struck the window and it had perished. But what amazed me even more than the incident itself was the species of bird. Here I was looking at a hermit thrush that is a species famous not only in biology but also in literature. Biologists are fascinated by the way hermit thrushes can sing two notes at once, and they do so using very similar harmonic intervals to the minor scales in human music. So their voice is hauntingly beautiful. And because of that, they're famous in literature. They've been used in hundreds of poems and songs and pieces of literature of all kinds. Walt Whitman called upon the hermit thrush to sort of symbolize the nation's grief in his elegy to Abraham Lincoln. So this is a very famous bird in both of my chosen professions, whether it's science or writing, and I had had no idea until that moment that this bird was spending the winter in my backyard. And so that invited the obvious question of what else am I overlooking close to home? And that was the inspiration for the book.
So tell us about the backyard life of Charles Darwin.
Darwin is very famous, of course, for his theory of evolution by natural selection. And the first thing we all think about are the finches in the Galapagos, when he traveled the world on the beagle as the naturalist, and he had this collecting experience there that later on really inspired part of his theory. But after that one long voyage around the world, he never went anywhere. Charles Darwin was actually a famous homebody. And the vast majority of his work in the sciences was conducted in his own backyard. He lived at a place called Downhouse on a piece of land, about 19 acres. He rented a little piece of a field from a neighbor next door. So he had this sort of living laboratory right there in his neighborhood and spent decades following up on all sorts of natural history questions that led to and reinforced his great discoveries and theories in a range of fields, but of course all centered around his theory of evolution.
For a long time, ordinary people were discouraged from attempting to contribute to science. Leave it to the experts. Now there are several ways we can engage as citizen scientists. For example, what is SciStarter?
SciStarter is what they call, an aggregator of citizen science opportunities. It's a website that gathers information from all of these projects where they're using data and observations gathered by individuals, anyone who wants to participate and send in information to the program. So it's a wonderful place to start. You can sort by geography or sort by topic and find out projects where scientists are asking for help in creating these data sets. I mean, it all boils down to the fact that there's a lot of data out there in the world and there aren't that many scientists. So there are these great collaborations going on where people can fill in that great gap there, fill in the blanks, and help scientists answer all sorts of questions about really pressing topics, everything from biodiversity declines to pollinator issues to climate change. All of these things being addressed through the observations we can make, right outside our back doors.
Unfortunately, nature can be invisible even when we walk directly through it. We've got Spotify in our ears and our eyes are checking messages and posting. We may worry about our job or paying the rent all the way through the park. How can we break out of that to really look?
Well, I think retraining our eyes is a really important aspect of sort of reconnecting with backyard biology. And it takes a bit of effort to do it. Because we've all developed, not only are we distracted by technology and so forth, but we've developed all sorts of filters to sort of block out extraneous information. Because in the human world, we live in a place with things clamoring for our attention, from advertisements to screens to music to what have you. Everything is designed to distract us. So we have these filters, and they block out things in nature just as easily as they block out, someone's distracting ringtone, for example. So we need to sort of strip those things down. There are various things that we can do. They involve, going out after dark with a flashlight where you've narrowed your field of observation to a single beam of light. They involve things like closing our eyes and listening in nature, sitting still. Or one thing that I really enjoyed doing in my own yard was getting down on hands and knees and crawling through the yard, which immediately changes your whole perspective on the place. And you see things and smell things you would never see when you were standing up. And it also makes your yard seem a lot bigger because it takes a long time to get across it. So that is one of the ways that I really tried to retrain my eyes to see more in the yard.
Actually, I crawl around a bit when I'm gardening, and I'm really close up, and I have to be. And they say it's good for people of all ages to be able to crawl and to do it. And, I use my backyard space as a kind of clock. It's an experience of time. I mean, the pear trees flower first, so that tells me not just where I am, but when I am. And this idea that each of us is part of a celestial clock, it's comforting to me. Do you feel that?
There are so many seasonal events that occur outdoors that ground us in the world. And you don't need to live at Charles Darwin's estate to experience these things. You see these seasonal events everywhere you live. You experience them, you live them when you decide what clothes you're going to put on for the day. All of those things happening right outside are connecting us to the natural world. So in my family, we look forward to certain things like the first bumblebee sighting of the year, or we look forward to the nettles that come up in spring. Or in the fall, we start to look forward to the birds that are passing through on their way south again after a summer spent north in their breeding grounds. So there are various seasonal events that we can tune into. And I will add that that kind of observation is not only personally fulfilling and rewarding, but it's another one of those ways that you can contribute to scientific understanding. In that when we're studying something like climate change, one of the things that really starts to alter very quickly is the timing of seasonal events. So as soon as you start writing down or recording, even maybe it's a picture on a cell phone, whatever it is, something with a date stamp, you are taking data that has real value to scientists as they try to track how our world is changing as the planet warms.
So tell us about iNaturalist, founded by ecologist Scott Laurie, and the Global Biodiversity Information Facility. What are these things?
Well, iNaturalist started out as sort of a social media for people curious about nature, a place where you could post pictures and get help in identifying what you just saw, you know, on your walk through the park or your crawl through your backyard or what have you. And it sort of struck a nerve. It just, people glommed onto this and began to post things and spread the word, and it's grown to millions of users around the world and become a real great source, not only for people to learn about the nature around them, but it's become a great source for scientists. And Scott Laurie had this great notion when he got involved that it would fill in the gaps that he had seen when he was a full-time academic, and he had written a very well-received paper about what we were just talking about how seasonal events were changing and how species were adjusting their habitats, if you will. They were adjusting their home ranges, shifting across the landscape, sort of looking for the temperatures and conditions they were accustomed to. So things were moving across the landscape, and in some cases, they were moving away from the habitats we protected to save them. And so he made all these interesting, you know, predictions and so forth, and he said journalists were calling him and asking him, well, what's happening out there? I mean, where are the species now? What's going on? And he said, well, you know, I don't know. It's all done with models and theories. We don't really have data on it. So when he got involved in iNaturalist, he realized that here are all these people out there with their smartphones taking pictures of things they see in nature. And when you do that, you have a location, you have a species, you have a time, you have a date stamp, you have a piece of data. And when you multiply that by the millions of people who are involved, it has become a treasure trove for scientists, not just Scott, but scientists around the world. Because as soon as those pieces of information now from iNaturalist, and there are other examples too, but that's one of the big ones, as soon as they're, you know, confirmed by as legitimate, you saw, you know, a hermit thrush in your yard in the Pacific Northwest on such and such a day. Well, then that data gets uploaded to GBIF, this global database of biodiversity information. And scientists from around the world are accessing that all the time when they need data on species ranges and where things are moving and migrations and so on and so forth. And the thing that really struck me when I talked with Scott and learned more about how this was all developing was that most of the scientists now who are just going to GBIF for data, they don't even realize that the data is being gathered by people in their backyards and so forth. They, because GBI, it's all seen as, you know, scientifically sound. It's all been verified. It's all perfectly good. So they're just using it as they would use data they gathered or created in their own lab. And I think that's really profound because it means that the observations of citizen scientists have simply become part of the scientific firmament. We no longer question the validity of what people can see and do right outside their back door.
And this link up between local witnesses and scientists all over the place, there is the TreeZilla project in the UK, and you found examples where scientists managed to use this data gathered by the rest of us?
Oh, in so many ways. I mean, how much time do we have? We could go on with fabulous examples, but if we want to look at something, one of the most basic questions in science, which is what is out there? What species are there in the world? We don't even have a full list, not even close. And so now you see people actually making species discoveries through many of these projects, even in places like the heart of Los Angeles. The BioScan project went out and trapped insects in people's backyards, and they've already found over 50 species just in one family of flies that they were examining in that project in these, it's one of the most urbanized landscapes on the planet, and there are all these undiscovered species. And now people are looking through, things on iUniverse. Even high school students in California were looking through iUniverse and saw a couple of scorpion pictures that no one had been able to put a name on. So they looked at where they were taken, they went out, they found these scorpions, got more information, and they discovered new species as a project in high school. So it's people of all stripes, not just scientists, who are now able to access all of this great information and make some remarkable discoveries.
Radio EcoShock also broadcasts in Australia, and what can we learn from parrots in the garbage bins in Sydney?
I love that project. I love it. So one of the things that you look for, once you start to retrain your eyes to the creatures living all around you, is not just what they are, but what they're doing. And this is a wonderful example of that, in that Barbara Klump and others, her colleagues, designed this project looking at sulfur-crested cockatoos in the suburbs of Sydney, Australia. They were building on some work that had shown how these birds were spreading out across the city to forage during the daytime and then coming back to communal roosts at night. And it was a really interesting sort of ecological system that they had developed socially. So they were looking at these birds, and they realized that some of them in certain neighborhoods had developed techniques for opening people's garbage cans. So they enlisted all of these volunteers. They actually had radio ads saying, hey, have you seen this happening in your neighborhood? Please get in touch with us. And they had hundreds of people contributing their observations of the parrots hopping up on their garbage can and finding a way to get the lid open and tilting it back. And what they realized as they gathered the data and they followed this through several seasons was that different parrots in different neighborhoods had developed different techniques. And they were teaching those techniques to the other parrots in their parrot populations. So what you had going on was not only an interesting behavior, but you had all the hallmarks for the development of a culture. Because a culture is, by definition, behaviors that are learned and inherited through generations that vary geographically in different populations. This is why, the cuisine of Italy is different from the food found in Mexico, both of which stand in stark contrast to the pickled herring and lutefisk of Norway, for example. When we have traditions passed down, these learned social behaviors that vary in different populations, we call it culture. And we do the same thing in wild populations. But it's very rare in nature. Very rare. You have chimpanzees with different mechanisms for tool use when they're fishing for termites. You have a few populations of whales and dolphins with distinctive feeding behaviors. There are some behaviors in crows that vary geographically. But it's extremely rare. And here in the backyards and driveways of Sydney, Australia, they were able to see culture developing in this big divided population of parrots. So a tremendous discovery for animal behaviorists, and all made in these very commonplace settings with the observations of everyday people.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Thor Hansen. We're talking about his new book, Close to Home. And I learned from your book that more than half of all living things are underground. We don't see half of nature. You dug a hole in your backyard for exploration. What sorts of things did you find?
This is one of the mysteries that continues to confound us, is just how much is going on out of sight underground, right there beneath our feet. And a lot of the biodiversity there is small, but it's no less fantastic. Once you start to dig and really get your snoot down there and poke around, you can see all of these tiny creatures, little insects and worms and other small creatures, springtails, and you have little tardigrades and all kinds of things. But another thing that you notice in almost any patch of dirt that you sort through is all of these little strands of white material that are the hyphae of various species of fungus. And the fungal diversity of the soil is truly remarkable and has only just recently begun to sort of get its due in the scientific community and in the public eye as we start talking about how different plants, trees, and so forth can exchange nutrients and information through these networks of fungal strands beneath the ground. But it's not only what the fungi do for the plant community, but it's how these fungi interact with other things and with themselves. Because it's dark and everything that goes on under there, a lot of it is done through chemistry. The fungi and soils have become incredibly adept at producing novel compounds. So one of my favorite examples from the book was a project led by a fellow named Robert Sitchewitz at the University of Oklahoma, where he and colleagues were talking about how they really wanted to explore the compounds that fungi were making in soils. But they didn't have the wherewithal in terms of grant funding to go across the country sampling soils all over the place. So they decided they would see if people would volunteer to send in little samples of soil, just a couple of tablespoons. You don't need much, right? And so they put out a plea, and this thing took off, and they got thousands of samples from around the country, and they began to look at these, and they partnered with the National Institute of Health to sort of rebuild the library of compounds that scientists look for in terms of generating new drugs and medical treatments. And they started doing it from these backyard soil samples and found thousands of novel compounds, many of which are already in the pipeline for study as potential cancer drugs and so forth. One of my favorite examples, one single sample from a backyard up in Alaska, a woman, dug up a little soil and sent it in. And just from that one sample, they found a compound that is under study as a promising treatment for breast cancer. And in the same sample, they found another compound with a peculiar characteristic. It just neutralizes odors. They tested it with the odor from skunks, and in an instant, it just neutralizes the odor from the skunk. They tried all sorts of other stinky things, and it was very effective. So they have now partnered with a company, not surprisingly, in the pet trade, that is going to try and use it to make the world's finest kitty litter and so forth. So all of that from one sample of soil, because the fungi there use these chemicals to defend their territory or to aggress against their neighbors and hold on to their patch of ground. And they have all sorts of untold uses for the human community.
Right now, humans are creating massive new landscapes in cities like Tokyo and New York. Are animals adapting? Are they even evolving to fit them? Is the city mouse really different than the country mouse?
Well, your example of the mice is a very apt one, in that there's a fascinating study now from mice and other rodents, but particularly mice now, in places like Central Park. where their diet has become so different from the diet of, you know, field mice and deer mice and so on in the countryside, because they're, you know, gathering up peanuts and Cheetos and other things that people toss on the ground there, that they are in fact measurably evolving a different suite of enzymes in their gut to digest these things. So yes, the city mouse is a different sort of mouse, and you see a lot of examples of this occurring now, because the urban habitats we've created are distinct. And what you need, if you're going to, you know, evolve and even evolve different varieties, subspecies, or even whole new species, you need distinct influence of habitat, and you need isolation. So if you get these populations of city creatures that are isolated from those in the countryside and exposed to these new conditions, it can be a sort of a laboratory for the evolution of new traits in real time.
And of course, not all of that is good. Some things also bring diseases and so on. And in fact, I missed your 2021 book, Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid, The Fraught and Fascinating Biology of Climate Change. Do you want to stick in just one story from that book about how climate and biology are working together?
Oh, there are so many stories. I mean, this is such a dominant part of biology now. It's not really an exaggeration to say that all biologists are studying climate change. Some of them just don't know it yet. But the influence of the warming of the planet is being felt in systems everywhere. And we see, you know, the iconic image of the polar bear stranded on the melting iceberg as our sort of go-to symbol for biological impact. But often, or too often, in my opinion, the conversation stops there, and we forget what's happening in ecosystems around the world. It really is a dominant theme. So to take one story that I found particularly fascinating in the research for that book would be the story of what's happening right off the edge of that iceberg. If you could push that polar bear out of the way and look over the edge of the ice, you might catch a glimpse of a little seabird called the dovekie, or the little auk, is what it's called in Europe. And it's a little ocean feeder that goes right along the edge of the ice. This has been their habit for millennia, feeding on little plankton, zooplankton, that gather where that melting ice interacts with the seawater. It's a wonderful strategy. But it has become a challenge for them in a warming situation, what we have now, where the ice is receding farther and farther from Arctic islands where the dovekies breed. So the distance that they have to travel between the nest and their feeding grounds is getting longer and longer. And for years now, biologists have predicted that dovekies would be one of the first Arctic species to perhaps even disappear, certainly decline, but disappear, because that distance was getting too great for them to bring enough food back to feed their chicks. And you don't need the PhD in ornithology to know what happens if the chicks aren't getting enough to eat. The population will crash. So a few years ago, some ornithologists participated in this big trip up to the Arctic, where they were studying these things, a variety of things, but including dovekie reproduction in Franz Josef Land in Russia. And they got up there, and they'd done this kind of study elsewhere, and they had these little monitors they put on to the dovekies at their nesting site, and they released them, and they had predicted that they would need to be in the air for at least an hour to get to the pack ice and back to feed the chicks. So they had these monitors going, and they downloaded the first day of data, and they were astounded, because the dovekies had been in the air for only 4 minutes. So where on earth were they going? And they realized that the melting glaciers on these islands were sending down this blue glacial meltwater, and you could see it coming into the fjords and then slamming up against the dark currents of that Arctic Ocean. And at that interface, it created sort of like almost like a brick wall, so that the little crustaceans and zooplankton that were swimming through that ocean water would hit this fresh water of different salinity, different temperature, and they'd just be stunned or even knocked out. And all of the dovekies were lining up at that curtain of underwater stunned plankton and gorging themselves. So in fact, where you had predicted their populations to be declining, they were thriving and flying a shorter distance than they had ever flown to reach the edge of the pack ice. And in that situation then, with those glaciers melting, well, they won't last forever, but the dovekies have bought themselves more time, 100 years, maybe 200 years, with this new system in which to find other ways to adapt to a changing climate. So I love that story because it addresses what's happening right beyond the edge of the ice on the old polar bear image. And it shows us that nature doesn't just stand still when things change. Species do everything they can to try to adapt to new conditions. And if we can learn which ones are succeeding and how they're doing it, and learn which ones are not succeeding, it helps us to prioritize which species need our help. And it also helps us learn and how to prepare our own responses.
Your book helps us learn without seeming teachy. It's like a handbook, but you also call us to act. What are some of the next steps for action, Thor?
Well, I think in this current climate of climate change and these sort of global environmental crises, it can be really challenging for us to feel that our actions are more than trifles. And in that context, I think these sort of personal, direct, hands-on interactions with nature close to home, where we can see tangible results, are more important than ever before. They re-energize us for the broader fights, and they even contribute now through citizen science to those broader questions and solutions. So we're talking about not only what's in your backyard and what it's doing and how to see it better, but also how to help it. And there are many, many simple things that one can do that will noticeably and measurably increase the biodiversity on virtually any patch of ground. From the simplest of all, letting a patch of your lawn return to nature, to planting native plants or shrubs, putting up bird boxes for the cavity nesting species that might otherwise love the habitat in your neighborhood, but they don't have a place to nest. So there are all sorts of relatively simple things that one can do, not only to reconnect with nature, but to help it.
From Washington State, we've been speaking with conservation biologist and author Dr. Thor Hansen. His new book is Close to Home, The Wonders of Nature Just Outside Your Door. Find out more in my show notes, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org, and you can connect with Thor at thorhansen.net. Thor, thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you again for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.